Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil in the ones and twos. We're going to talk a little politics, but before that, I want to let you know our special guests today are civil rights pioneer Jim Obergefell and civil rights attorney Al Gerhardstein. So looking forward to having them here in just a few minutes. But first, Sherry, the mayor's race, we thought it was settled, but there's a potential issue here. What's going on?
Would it be a city election with last-minute chaos? Would it without it? we'll see what happens here. But, you know, we have a big week and a half in the mayor's race coming up here. First of all, as we record, we're still waiting to see if Kelly Prather and Adam Kaler are going to make the ballot. They're challenged. They don't have enough signatures, according to the Board of Elections. They've both challenged this, so we're kind of waiting for decisions there. I have to say, those challenges, they almost never go anywhere. You know, it's really hard. Some of these signatures, they're not valid. Even if you're contesting, you might get some, but not enough. So we're watching for that. So we have a race of six. We could see these two more added. So we're waiting for that. In the meantime, here we go. There is a problem. There's an alleged problem with the petitions that every candidate filled out. Attorney Kurt Hartman is kind of really always, you know, adhered to the charter, brought up a charter issue, and has filed a lawsuit. He's using AFTAB Puraval, the candidate Puraval, to make his case, but this is a case that's really going to affect all of these candidates should something happen. What's going on is it looks like the charter requires petition gatherers to sign an affidavit, a legal document, swear under oath that we're going to do this the right way. What maybe we have, it's hard to tell. This is part of what's going to be litigated here, is that they signed a statement making all those same promises. And does this nuance matter? Kurt Hartman, in his lawsuit, is alleging, right to the Ohio Supreme Court, he's alleging that it does matter. And as a result, AFTAB Puraval, he didn't read the charter right, and his petitions, his signature gathering, should not be correct. But everybody got the same paperwork. It's not just, you know, Canada Puraval who this is going to affect. If for some, and this is a fast-tracked case, when you file an elections case, they have to hear it, and this is being heard in written form with a flurry of motions happening right now. And then I think that we could hear a decision next week from the Ohio Supreme Court. But we're on a massive deadline here for this ballot, and that's what's going on. The ballots, okay, you're like, oh, the primary's in May, March 17th. There is a handful of ballots that have to go out overseas, and those have to be mailed by March 17th. And that means, is it 17th or 19th? Oh, I left my notes at my desk. Sorry, you guys. One of the two, but that's still pretty quick, and that's, you know, next week. And so this issue kind of has to be set in stone. If for some reason, if Kurt Hartman prevails and AFTAB's petitions don't count, expect him to, you know, make the case that none of the candidates' petitions count. And then what happens?
No one's running for mayor.
And I literally don't know how that would work. Even write-in candidates have to, like, file some paperwork and say, I'd like to be a write-in candidate. Someone had done that, and then she pulled her name off, so she's not doing that. And so, hence the word chaos.
That sounds like we're in the weeds just a bit on this one. I'm going to, for now, stick with it being a three top contenders in David Mann, AFTAB Puraval, Cecil Thomas, and like you said, the candidate list could grow to eight by the end of this week. So should we jump over and do our special guest segment?
I mean, I could talk about the mayor's race all day, but sure.
All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Pleased to welcome to That's So Cincinnati for the first time, civil rights pioneer Jim Obergefell and civil rights attorney Al Gerhardstein. Gentlemen, how are you?
Great, thank you. doing well. Thanks for having us on.
You know, the Inquirer has told your story so many times, but it's worth telling again and again, just to make sure history does not repeat itself. But, you know, we're kind of here today. Netflix has this new documentary series, right? It has this big name, Will Smith, right? Amend, The Fight for America. And it's these episodes about the 14th Amendment. But I think everyone in Cincinnati, and this is That's So Cincinnati, knows who the real stars are. You too. And so we wanted to have you on to kind of just talk, you know, just about how you changed our world. And I don't think that's an understatement.
Well, that's very kind of you. Let me start, and then Jim will pick it up, because my work goes back even further than Jim's in many respects, because I've been trying to do gay rights litigation and secure gay people equal rights for decades. And Cincinnati was the most hostile place in the country to gay people. And I thought the documentary did a good job of putting Cincinnati in the center of the narrative, because, of course, at one point in 1993, the people of Cincinnati passed by a 64% margin Article 12, an amendment to our charter that isolated, targeted this one group, LGBTQ people, and said they can't assert any rights. They deserve no protection. They can't even have a human rights ordinance or anti-discrimination laws. And it banned any amendment to the charter that would carry give them such protections. And while we litigated to try and undo that using the 14th Amendment, we ultimately failed, even with two trips to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the story of how the second founding, that is the use of the 14th Amendment to expand rights for black people, to expand rights for women, to expand rights for people who have disabilities, also includes the struggle for gay rights. And in Cincinnati, our initial litigation was not successful. And the people who voted by 64% to deny gay people rights had to come back in 2004 and repeal Article 12. And what's really curious is that while people woke up and started to extend folks, gay people rights in 2004 in Cincinnati, that was the same year that Ohio passed the marriage ban. And so once again, gay people were targeted and told that they cannot marry on an equal basis with opposite sex couples. And that ultimately sort of woke up Jim and John.
So I do have a question, Al. When you went went to law school, did you concentrate on being a civil rights lawyer? And did you see LGBTQ plus rights as being, you know, your life's work at that point?
I did go to law school to become a civil rights lawyer. I had a public interest fellowship in a program called the Ruth Tilden Program at NYU Law. And the whole point was to do civil rights work. I had not focused on gay rights, but I had focused on civil rights generally, police misconduct, reproductive health, sex discrimination. But I woke up to gay rights very early in my career when my brother, who is gay, was part of a problem in Cleveland. He moved in with his partner, his same-sex partner in Cleveland, and then his partner was promptly fired from his job as a music teacher in a Catholic school up there. And I represented his partner before the Vicar of Education and tried to assert that the Catholic Church had no right to discriminate against him as a gay man. And I lost that case, too.
Al, what year was that?
That was like 1981 or so.
So, but you persisted. And it seems like, I mean, if we bring up to, like, as we're getting to this point with Jim and John, you just kept following it, and you knew, I mean, this case ultimately was rooted in the death certificate. So, Jim, can you tell us a little bit about your story? So now you're in Cincinnati, you meet John, and you have your life here, and you talked about on the Netflix documentary how you didn't see yourself as an activist, but here is Al, you know, right down the street from you, doing this work.
Right. So, you know, John and I met, you know, during the summer that I came out, and we became a couple over New Year's Eve, 1992 into 93. And so here we were starting a relationship in Cincinnati when that charter amendment was passed. And Al, I have to say, I always refer to Cincinnati at that time as the most gay unfriendly city in the country.
Right.
But I love your word hostile, because that's a much more accurate description of what it was like. So early on, John and I started talking about marriage, and it was something that we wanted, but we also agreed that for us, it couldn't just be symbolic. We wanted to marry, but we wanted it to carry legal weight. So we just thought that would never, ever be an option for us. We didn't see marriage being something we could enter into legally and have it recognized in our lifetimes. Now, John and I, we were not activists. I like to say our mode of activism was checkbook activism. We would support financially organizations and causes we cared about. That was it. But life has a way of throwing things at you that you don't expect. And as weird as it is, I can honestly say if it weren't for John being diagnosed with ALS, most of this would have never happened. But, you know, in 2012, he was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And as he lost every ability, you know, he started at-home hospice care in April of 2013. I was his full-time caregiver. And on June 26, 2013, when the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act in their decision in United States versus Windsor, I just spontaneously proposed to John. And he said yes. But now here we were living in Cincinnati. You know, yes, the great thing, our fellow Cincinnatians, our neighbors had repealed that horrible charter amendment. But as Al mentioned, in 2004, Ohio passed their state level version of the Defense of Marriage Act. So we decided to get married, but we couldn't do it in Cincinnati. Which, you know, in a perfect world, I could have put John in his wheelchair and taken him the six blocks to the county courthouse, but we couldn't do that. We had to get married in a different state. But we had to figure out how to do that with a man who could do nothing for himself, a man who was nearing the end of his life due to ALS. And we ended up chartering a medical jet and flying to Baltimore Washington International Airport to get married. And we never left that medical jet. And
it's one of my favorite stories that the Inquirer has ever done.
Yeah, by Julie Zimmerman. Yeah.
One of our coworkers, and she doesn't work here anymore, but she just saw your story and wanted to tell your love story. And she went and she just turned this amazing story. And I think it resonated with everyone in this city. And you read that, Al, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I have to say, she did such an amazing job with it. And she was a friend and a neighbor, a North Avondale neighbor. And she was someone we trusted, someone we knew, someone we really cared for and liked. So when someone you know says, hey, would you be willing to let me write a story about you? It made us comfortable, it made us feel safe, because it was someone we knew, someone that we trusted. And yeah, that story certainly kicked off something pretty amazing when Al was told our story by other mutual friends at a party shortly after we got married.
You know, and I was very excited for Jim and John, and they were thrilled. But having done a large number of wrongful death cases, I knew what a death certificate looked like. And I knew that despite the 14th Amendment, at that point, Ohio would not recognize Jim and John's Maryland marriage. So they had gone to all this trouble to get legally married in a place that recognized their own marriage, that is in Maryland, but they weren't going to be able to use that Maryland marriage certificate for some of the most important things that were coming. And that was properly recognizing John's death, properly listing him as married on the death certificate, and properly listing Jim as the surviving spouse. Instead, Ohio was going to say that John was single and leave the surviving spouse blank. And this is why this series, the Netflix series, is so critical to helping people appreciate what we've done in this country. The second founding, as we call the 14th Amendment, has Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which one part of it says, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction equal protection of the law. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, wait a minute. If a 16-year-old girl goes and gets married in Georgia, it's a legal marriage, but it's not legal for her to get married in Ohio. But if she comes back to Ohio, Ohio will recognize her marriage. If a cousin wants to get married to a first cousin in Ohio at the time, that you couldn't do that. But if those two cousins got married in Massachusetts and then came back to Ohio, Ohio would recognize the marriage. So I'm thinking, well, let's use the Windsor case. Let's use these common sense notions of equality and see if we can get marriage recognition for Jim and John. And that sent us off to court.
You know, when John and I decided to get married, it was because for the first time in our almost 21 years together, we could get married and have it recognized by the government, the federal government at least. And we knew Ohio wouldn't recognize that marriage, but honestly, that was an abstract knowledge. You know, we knew they wouldn't recognize it, but it was really meeting Al, and when he pulled out that blank Ohio death certificate, that suddenly that abstract knowledge, that abstract understanding became real, and it became harmful and hurtful.
And I didn't know for sure that this was the right thing for them. They had to make their own decision. They were at that point in our lives when your highest priority is supporting your loved one. I mean, John's in a hospital bed in one room in their condo, and Jim is taking care of them. And, you know, squeezing in giant social activism at that stage of their lives might be a stretch, and I wanted to make sure they knew what we were all talking about. But they seemed pretty resolute that they wanted to proceed.
Yeah, I have to say, it was one of the easiest decisions we've ever made. And I know a big part of that was Al. I mean, he made us feel so comfortable with the concept, with the idea of filing suit against the city of Cincinnati and the state of Ohio, that it was something we could consider. And while I think a lot of people would ask Jim, John, how could you do this at this point of John's life? Jim, why would you willingly take time away from John? We saw it as just part of living up to our promises to love, honor, and protect each other. And to us, saying, yes, let's do this, was just our way of fighting for each other and respecting and living up to respecting our marriage, respecting our relationship, and fighting for each other and living up to those promises.
It does go all the way through the courts, and it gets to the U.S. Supreme Court. So how many times had you been there before, Al?
Only a couple times, but let me just circle back to Cincinnati really quickly, because while we called it the most hostile place for LGBTQ people back in 2004, by 2014 or 2013, when we filed this case, things that's really started to change in Cincinnati. And I actually felt a little bad that I had to sue the city as part of this case. The actual birth certificate is issued through the Cincinnati, I'm sorry, death certificate is issued through the Cincinnati Bureau of Vital Statistics. So they were a necessary party to the lawsuit. And one of the bright spots in this whole case at the very beginning was the state got up and, you know, made its argument against us. And then the city got up and said, you know what, we're not going to oppose the plaintiffs. We support the plaintiffs. And that was pretty cool. They supported Jim and John.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite moments in that hearing. And just to, again, reiterate how much Cincinnati had changed, City Council proclaimed our wedding day, July 22nd, 2013, as John Arthur and Jim Obergefell Day in the city. So just another indication of how dramatically attitudes had changed in Cincinnati.
Does it, and I, that was what I want to ask you about, Cincinnati, the change, and do you still have to pinch yourself sometimes and think, knowing that you, what was going on in the early 90s to today?
Well, I certainly do. I mean, I'm very impressed with how our community has grown with respect to gay rights and opening its doors to trans people and to so many varieties of people. I'm very proud of our city. Of course, it's, you know, we had to fight to get to this point, but we're here, and I think we have every right to feel good about where Cincinnati's at this point.
And I just have to agree wholeheartedly with that. It's an amazing thing when I think about what Cincinnati was like when I moved there in 1984 to what it was when John and I became a couple in the early 90s to today. It's honestly unrecognizable from a cultural point of view and from the just the way the city is towards the LGBTQ plus community and really all marginalized communities.
Yeah, it really is. I remember coming to, I grew up in another part of Ohio, but I remember coming to UC in 93 and just, you know, like it was called like the most conservative city in America at the time. And I'm kind of a dumb young college student, but, you know, I didn't realize what that meant. But, you know, now looking back, it's like, oh, you realize hearing you guys talk about this, kind of what that meant.
Yeah.
Jim, what has it meant, and Al, really, both of you, what has it meant that this happened and that you're these pioneers now? Like, is it part of your daily lives now? Do people talk about this with you? Like, what have the last, you know, 5.5 years been like?
Well, for me, Sherry, my life is completely different from what it was prior to the case. You know, as I mentioned, I was never an activist, but that has certainly changed. I find I can't live my life without continuing to fight for equality, for civil rights, and it's expanded to be not just LGBTQ plus focused, but for all marginalized communities. I have to be involved. So even today, people, when they realize who I am or they meet me, they still hug me. Well, not in COVID times, but they would hug me, shake my hand, tell me stories, show me photos of the person they love or their children. And I have to tell you, it's an amazing thing to be asked by parents, hey, could we take a picture of you with our child? Because thanks to you and the other plaintiffs in the case, we know our child can marry the person they love, whoever that happens to be. So it's been this amazing change for me. And yes, I have lost some anonymity. People do recognize me. They certainly know my name. They know a lot about my story. But giving up some of that anonymity, it's so worth it because I see the difference it's made in our nation. I know the hope it's given the younger generations. And I love that those younger generations, they're growing up in a world now where from the start, marriage is a possibility. They know that they can marry the person they love. And all of those things are just an amazing gift to me and an amazing thank you for, I guess, you know, John and I deciding, yes, we're going to fight for each other. I certainly never expected to be a name and face known across the country. I certainly never in my life dreamt of having my name on a landmark Supreme Court case. But it's all related to something so wonderful that I can't be upset about anything that happens to me because it has just made such a difference in our nation.
Well, I was just going to piggyback on that. I was equally inspired not only by the other plaintiffs and the other cases that had gone before ours and were argued with ours, but also by Jim and John. Jim is, you know, grieving through the last half of his case. I mean, John died in October of 13, and then we actually had to get the death certificate and had to carry through. And the states, they're threatening to say that they're going to repeal that death certificate and change it back when they win the case. And, you know, he's dealing with all those feelings at the same time we're pressing ahead with this lawsuit. And he was a very inspiring and positive person to work with. And of course, when we won, the contrast between this and my other cases, where I've usually got grieving mom or families and the constitutional abuses of fighting over it caused death and destruction. Here, the win turns into a huge national parade. The White House is lit up. You know, we come back to Gay Pride Day. We're in the parade. I mean, it's just such a celebration and such a statement about love and how the Constitution, in its wording, in the liberty protections, embraces love and protects love. And there's just nothing better than that as a civil rights attorney.
Jim, do you do a lot of, are you all over the country speaking? Do you do a lot of speaking? Has this become like a full-time thing for you?
Well, as you can imagine, over the past year, not so much.
Yeah.
I mean, I've certainly had
a lot of Zoom
several, right. I've certainly had several virtual speaking engagements. And the first 2 to 3 years, yes, my full-time job was speaking engagements, events, doing things around the country, even a bit around the world in Ireland and Australia.
Presiding at weddings, you did that too.
Yes, and also officiating weddings because I decided, much like John's Aunt Paulette, who officiated our wedding, I went to the same website that she used and clicked the ordain me button and got ordained to officiate weddings. So I think I've officiated around 20 now, and that's been for both same sex and opposite sex couples. And that's been such a joy to be able to do that. But my life, yes, for the first, I'd say 2 to 3 years after the decision, really was full-time speaking, being an activist. And since then, speaking has slowed down a little bit, not surprisingly, but I have continued to speak. I've continued to be involved as an activist. I'm now the director of individual giving with Family Equality, which is an organization that's working towards legal and lived equality for LGBTQ+ families. So I am a full-time activist, and part of that is speaking and continuing to write at times. So my life is nothing like what it was before this.
I do want to encourage people to watch the documentary. You really get the full scope of everything in it. It's so well done. I was crying. I teared up and just kind of remembering all of that coming together. But also you wrote a book, Love Wins, that, you know, kind of goes into all of this. And there's like, you know, it's a different perspective than the documentary offered. Because it's just your life story and Cincinnati story, not through the prism of the 14th Amendment as the documentary is. So both things really together, you just get a full understanding of really how much this mattered.
Right. You know, the book certainly was quite a fun experience. Being able to write that with Debbie Sensiper, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. Also, she used to be a family member of John's, so there was that personal connection. And you're right, it's really the personal story of us. But what I love about the book is it's more than just us. It really goes in depth about Al and his amazing experience as a civil rights attorney. And it's also several of the other stories, the other plaintiffs, Pam and Nicole, Joe and Rob, who were part of Al's birth certificate case. So it's really a great book because it gives you the personal stories behind this legal case. And then, as you say, Amend, what an amazing documentary series. And, you know, I know our decision was based on the 14th Amendment, but that was kind of an abstract thing in my mind. I understood it somewhat, but boy, does this series help me understand it even more. And I think they did an amazing job of, you know, telling John's and my story, but also so many of the other stories around marriage equality, but then all of the other ways the 14th Amendment has helped move our country forward towards actually living up to we the people.
Jim, if John were here today, what do you think he'd say to you?
He would say, Jim, you keep doing all of the public stuff. I'm just going to stay here, sit here surrounded by friends, watching you do it, maybe having a glass of bourbon while you do it. So, I mean, I think he would be amazed to see the changes I've gone through because of this. I think he'd be incredibly proud. And I think he would be really, really just happy to know that our relationship, our love for each other really did make a difference, not just in our nation, but around the world. I think he would be stunned and just thoroughly gratified by that.
Okay, so as we're kind of wrapping up here, where does the fight go next? Al, I mean, is it done? I feel like it's never really done.
Oh, no. You know, one of the things that we were fighting for before marriage equality was just equality in all aspects of public life. And Ohio is one of those states that still doesn't have basic civil rights protection for LGBTQ people. So you can still be discriminated against for being gay, on a job, in a place of public accommodation. It's hard to believe, but in all these private settings that are protected for blacks and women and people of national origin, gays don't have it. And we have to change that in Ohio and amend the national Title VII or have a freestanding statute, which is pending, so that we can bring equality fully around to protect everyone.
You know, when the decision came down, some people thought, great, the fight for LGBTQ plus equality is over. We've won. I never felt that. And in fact, the backlash to the decision made it clear that we certainly weren't finished. You know, all I have to do is mention Kim Davis. Things like that, where even though we have that constitutional right to marry now in all 50 states, we really don't enjoy marriage equality because our marriages are still treated differently from opposite sex marriages. We're still treated less than. You know, we have photographers, bakers, clerks of court, all who refuse to work with us because somehow our love, our marriage, somehow infringes on their right to believe or to practice their religion the way they want to at home or in their place of worship. So we might have the right to marry, but as Al so rightly said, you know, we could get married on a Saturday, but on Monday lose a job or be evicted from our apartment. And that's where we have to really keep fighting for those non-discrimination protections. The Ohio Fairness Act has been introduced, which would do that for the state of Ohio. The Equality Act would do that at the federal level by updating the 1964 Civil Rights Act to include sexual orientation and gender identity. And beyond that, you know, within the LGBTQ plus community, our transgender community, they're the ones who are really at such risk. They can't live their lives in so many places without fearing for their lives. So, yes, we've made great progress between Obergefell, the Windsor case, Bostock, which said that sex discrimination includes discrimination against people because of sexual orientation or gender identity in the workplace. We have that. But that doesn't apply to every type of employer. So we still have a lot of work to do. And the fight continues.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today and sharing your story and about this and the history. And I know our listeners will really appreciate you coming on today. So thank you very much, Al and Jim.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. And congratulations, Cincinnati. You're doing a good job.
I would love to say ditto to that, Al. You're doing a great job. And Al, as always, it's a pleasure to spend time with you and talk with you. Thank you for all you've done. And Sherry and Jason, thanks for having us on. This has really been an enjoyable time.
All right, thanks again to Jim and Al for joining us here today. And Sherry, that takes us into our That's So Cincinnati Moment of the Week segment. And what do you got?
I don't know why it is, but for some reason, it seems like so many of our That's So Cincinnati things revolve around food.
It's a big food town.
And it's spring. And we know it's spring because I was out running some errands last evening, and there we go, right by the Zip Dip in Green Township, and they're open, and Jack Coolidge is like, can we stop? And when your 12-year-old asks you that, the answer is not, I'm on a diet. It's, sure we can. This is how we know it's spring. It's the first time this season. A whole bunch of these opened. The Inquirer has a list up right now. Like, this is a real sign of spring in Cincinnati, I think. And which ones are open? A lot of them are already open, including the Zip Dip. There was a line, too. There was no parking. And I would say there was a line of about 10 people in front of us. So it's officially spring.
Yes, it is. My favorite. Man, I love pizza and ice cream, and I'm trying to avoid both right now. I haven't had ice cream since February 26th, and I usually...
It's telling when you know the date of the last time you had it, I think.
Yes, but I decided that was when I was going to cut it out, and our neighborhood dairy bar is also reopened. We went, and I was strong. I didn't order.
I'm impressed.
The kids got something, and they enjoyed it. And thank you for enjoying this podcast as I segue into that. Ooh, bad segue. Anyway, no, thank you so much for listening this week, and we'll catch you next week.